into Opportunity Detroit. I'm Ann Thomas, and on this edition of the show, we're going to talk about the rebirth of Detroit's train station, now called Michigan Central Station. It's in Corktown, and we'll be joined by Ford Motor Company's Mark Truby. There's a great restaurant called Oak and Reel in Detroit. You'll meet the chef and owner. And the Pope Francis Center has opened the doors to its $40 million bridge housing campus. Father Tim McCabe, the president and CEO of the Pope Francis Center, will join us to talk about this transformational project. An interesting show about great things happening in and around the D, coming up right after these messages. Welcome into Opportunity Detroit. I'm Ann Thomas, and to kick off today's show, we're going to talk about the spectacular opening of Michigan Central Station with Mark Truby, the Chief Communications Officer for Ford Motor Company. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Ann.
Big week for you, for Ford Motor Company. Talk a little bit about how big this is for Ford Motor Company and the city of Detroit, Mark.
Well, you know, it's first of all, the opening was something that for us was 6 years in the making.
Wow.
You know, back in 2018, you know, Bill had this idea. It was crazy, ambitious idea that what if, you know, what if we could take the most visible symbol of the problems and the issues that Detroit's had, the picture that everybody takes when they want to say, you know, Detroit's a broken city. What if we could transform that into, you know, an innovation hub, a place where everybody wants to come down and spend time, the center of a 30-acre campus that would be all about the future of transportation and make the Motor City again. So that was really, you know, that was the idea that was hatched 6 years ago. So to see that all come full circle, and, you know, the progress that's already been made at Michigan Central, but to open that station for everybody to see and to see it all sell out so quick, not only the concert, but the, you know, we're doing 11 days of public tours that just sold out almost instantaneously. And I think people, you know, people understand that, yes, it's a train station that was, you know, beautifully refurbished and rehabbed, but and reconstructed. But it's more than that. It's a symbol of, you know, the resilience and grit of this city and the people to make a better future here in Detroit.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, Mark, because when I see people talking about this on all of the different social media channels these days, they almost seem to be pretty emotional about this project.
Yeah, I think you're right. And it was interesting when we first, when Bill Ford made the decision to buy it and we first announced it, you probably remember that day.
Yes.
And then we set up just some tours for people to see, you know, what it was like inside of it. And people were in tears, you know, for different reasons. You know, maybe their father went away and came back from World War II there, or maybe they have childhood memories of that train station, or maybe they were just happy to see that, like, that somebody cared enough to make this effort because they care about the city of Detroit. For a lot of different reasons and a lot of personal reasons, people are emotional about it. And I've had the pleasure to be over there a lot in the past couple of weeks getting ready for, you know, the opening and all of that. And saw a lot of people come through, everybody from musical artists to, you know, politicians to just the construction workers that worked on it, that put their heart and soul into it, all kinds of different people come in and, you know, and some people are just really fighting tears almost to see what's happened. And it is an emotional story, but, you know, Detroit's been through a lot. You know, we went through the bankruptcy. We went through everything everybody knows about for the past, you know, decades. And to see this along with everything else that's going on, that's really positive. Now, there's a lot of work to do in the city, no doubt. But, I mean, I think there's just been a lot of positive momentum in the past few years. And this is kind of a capstone to that. So it's emotional.
We're talking to Mark Truby. He's the Chief Communications Officer for Ford Motor Company here on Opportunity Detroit today. Mark, can you paint a picture for what Michigan Central Station looks like right now for our listeners?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, so the building itself is, you know, spectacularly grand in the detail and just the beauty of it is breathtaking. It's just jaw-dropping. If you take a step back from that, it's the center of a 30-acre area in Corktown and also to the other side, Southwest Detroit. We also rehabilitated what we call the Book Depository Building, which was an Albert Kahn building that had, I mean, that, you think the train station was in rough shape. That building had, you know, trees growing through it. It's now beautiful again. There's 97 startups there. Very bustling hub of you know, startups and VCs, venture capital firms, all that kind of thing. But the train station now, I mean, I think we're ready to get going. You're going to see Ford take three floors for our advanced technology businesses. Google's going to be in there with Code Next. We're going to have a hotel on the upper floors. We're getting down to the finalists on who's going to be the hotel we choose to be on the upper floors. But the Grand Concourse, that beautiful Grand Concourse that's been immaculately restored, you know, that's going to be a place where if you live in Detroit and you've got friends coming in from out of town or family coming in from out of town, you're going to want to take them down there and you're going to want to go get a dinner or a drink or see an art installation or, you know, I think it's going to be one of those things where everybody wants to go down and spend the day there. The park in front of the station, Roosevelt Park, which was in rough shape 6 years ago when we bought the station, is now, I mean, the city did a fantastic job. That is a great, beautiful park area now, and there's going to be a lot of activity going on in the park. So, you know, it's just a wonderful now, you know, Corktown's Detroit's oldest neighborhood, and it's really on the rebound now, and that whole area is a big part of that.
And, you know, Mark, it seems to me that this project is likely life-changing for the people living in that area.
Yeah, it does change things, and we were very aware of that. And we were very aware that if you don't do it well, you might not always change things for the better.
Right.
So we spent a lot of time, you know, a lot of community meetings, just a lot of talking and listening to the community about what they wanted and what they didn't want. We wanted them to feel like Ford was moving in, but we weren't taking over, that we wanted to be part of the community. We wanted to improve the community. You know, for example, the folks at Southwest Detroit were saying, you know, we feel a little bit shut off from the station. It's almost like the station turns its back to us. And it, you know, it's part of our neighborhood too, like the Corktown Mexican Town area. So, you know, we really took that into account. And now when you go back there, you see, oh, there's going to be a greenway all the way down to the river. And so we were, by having a lot of dialogue with the communities and with Corktown, with Southwest Detroit, I think, you know, we did a pretty good job of trying to come in and be a neighbor and join that neighborhood as opposed to sort of a corporate takeover, which is absolutely what we didn't want. You know, because this isn't just going to be about Ford. Yes, Ford will be a presence there, and we own the properties. But, you know, there's going to be tons of other businesses and nonprofits and universities and academia, a lot of different groups mixing and mashing there. And definitely we want the community to appreciate it, and I think they will.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. Do you think we'll ever see trains in that area again?
I think it's not outside of the realm of possibility. There's definitely been talk of what-if kind of conversations,
sure,
which, you know, the same type of what-if conversations when we started saying, you know, what if we could restore this train station and make it the center of something bigger. You know, train travel in the United States, as everybody knows, particularly in the Midwest, is not, you know, as prevalent as on the East Coast or certainly in Europe and Asia and other parts of the world. For people like me, who spent 6 years in Europe and loved taking trains everywhere, I really hope that someday people will go to Michigan Central to pick up a train to go to Chicago, to go to New York or other places. I think that would be amazing. And
yes,
I think some people think the same, but you know, that's going to take some work and some planning in order for that to happen someday.
Mark Truby, what about you? You're the chief communications officer for Ford Motor Company. You've been involved in this from the beginning. How do you feel now that it's open personally?
Yeah, mostly I just feel privileged to be able to help tell the story, because that's kind of what my job is, to help tell the story of the company. And you know, I'm a former journalist. I spent years down at the Detroit News downtown when there was nothing downtown. And the Detroit News building was one of the few buildings that was nice downtown at that time, you know, that had been taken care of. And I saw the city, you know, I covered the city through, you know, some of those tough times, and saw, you know, the progress bit by bit, step by step, the casinos, then the Cadillac Hotel, then the Comerica Park, then more and more and more, then Dan Gilbert coming in with what he did, and, you know, Ford Field, Bill and Mayor Duggan putting Ford Field together. And I just saw bit by bit this story. And so, you know, I covered that as a journalist, and now to be able to help Ford tell the story of this, you know, is a privilege and kind of a cool opportunity. You know, it's something I've been working on and off for 6 years. So to be able to do the concert and to be able to have those public tours, and to the coverage you've seen, you know, the entire front page of the paper some days.
It's amazing. About, right.
Yeah. Like, I guess it's a dream for me as somebody involved in communications and public relations to have this opportunity. Because I don't think I don't know of any other company in the world that is doing a project quite like this. So that's pretty unique.
Well, and you know, Mark, there's a couple of other really good stories that you've been involved in, too. One of them being the draft, and the other one being the great success of the Detroit Lions.
Yeah, Detroit's having a moment, you know, if you really think about it.
Yes.
I went to two of those playoff games. I think those were the two most exciting sporting events I've ever been to in my life. Obviously, the draft was massive, and the city did an incredible job with you know, those crowds and the experience that they created. You know, you see, when you look at Detroit skyline, you see a crane, you know, over there with, you know, the new Bedrock building, the new skyscrapers. You know, you hadn't seen a lot of cranes in the air in Detroit in a long time.
You're right.
I think, you know, the combination of all of that, Detroit's having an incredible moment. And everywhere I go, you know, my friends and family that live in other places, you know, they're starting. Used to be, you said, you know, I live in Detroit, and they're like, ooh, how's that? Now they're like, oh, I hear Detroit's really cool now.
So, they're asking to come visit, right, Mark?
Yeah, they want to come visit. Oh, can I come to a Lions game? Or, you know, what's going on? You know, can you get me tickets to the concert? And so I think we're all of us that live here are feeling a little bit of that. Good momentum, and that's pretty exciting.
Mark Truby, Chief Communications Officer for Ford Motor Company, thank you so much for your time today and for joining us to tell the story. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Ann. It's been a pleasure.
Coming up next on Opportunity Detroit, if you haven't already, make a reservation at Detroit's Oak and Reel restaurant. The atmosphere and menu are great. We'll talk to the owner right after these messages. You are listening to Opportunity Detroit. I'm Ann Thomas. There's a great restaurant on East Grand Boulevard, and it's owned by Jared and Abby Gadbaugh. Jared is also the chef, and he's taking a bit of time away from his work today to talk to us on Opportunity Detroit. Jared, thanks for joining us. I really appreciate it.
We're happy to be here.
So, Jared, talk to us about this restaurant. I've been once, and I absolutely loved it. I loved the atmosphere, and I thought the food was fantastic.
Well, I think we need to get you back here if it's only been once.
We're right down the street.
Yeah, excellent. Yeah, so I grew up here in Michigan and had the opportunity to move to New York to learn how to cook, and spent about 15 years in the city and had a lot of great experiences, worked at a lot of great restaurants, had an opportunity to kind of travel the world and open up restaurants in Istanbul and Hong Kong, and eventually had two children and realized that it was time to come home. And so my wife and two kids moved back in 2018 to go about opening up Oak and Reel.
What's behind the name? Tell us about the name.
Oak and Real. It took us a bit of time to kind of suss this out, but we have a wood-burning hearth in the dining room that we use for a lot of our preparations here, and then we burn oak wood primarily in that hearth. So the oak comes from that, and then the neighborhood that we're in is a historic district. It's the Jam Handy district, and for those that don't know, it was a big movie production area in the early 1900s, where the auto industry and other industries, you know, would produce short films and such, and even Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, the original one was produced here in this district. So the reel comes from both a nod to the history of movie reels being filmed here, but also the fact that we are a primarily seafood focused restaurant. So a little nod to the fishing reel as well.
How did you pick that neighborhood? What a great story.
Having been in New York for 15 years, I was kind of tired of looking at tall skyscrapers and being surrounded by concrete. And I really wanted the feel of a neighborhood. I wanted to look out and see trees and grass and people. And you know, as I came back, we started looking, you know, I had a number of investors and they all said, oh no, you have to be downtown or midtown or maybe Corktown. And nothing really spoke to me. And so I just kind of kept looking. And eventually I had a size of a restaurant that I wanted. And I found this building out here in the Milwaukee Junction, North End area. And, you know, I said, hey, I think that it's got a good proximity to the Fisher Theater, the hospital. It's kind of smack between 75 and the Lodge. So, you know, people can easily get to it from the suburbs if they're coming from the northern suburbs. You know, it's right off of 94, so it just seemed like a great location, and it's got a great big parking lot here for all of our guests to park in for free. That's secure, and it just made sense at the time.
And you've got this incredible development coming with Michigan State and Henry Ford. So, wow, what a great location is right.
Yeah, we're excited for the future of this area. We hope that it just kind of continues to grow, and we can do our part to help encourage that growth.
We are talking to Jared Gadbaugh. He is the owner and chef of Oak and Reel. And Jared, let's talk now a little bit about your cooking style. You know, what is your style, and what should people know about you as the chef?
I think I'm a bit of a traditionalist. I went to culinary school. I went to the French Culinary Institute. My instructors were people like Jacques Pepin and Jacques Therese and Alain Sayac, and some of these kind of godfathers or grandfathers at this point in time of French cuisine. So I really learned the fundamentals of French cooking, stocks and sauce making, and you know, from some masters of this style. And I took that knowledge and worked in New York City for about 15 years, where I worked for a number of great places. I worked for, you know, at 11 Madison Park, which was once the number one in the world. I opened a restaurant called Maria that was, you know, where we earned James Beard Awards and Michelin stars. And it was just one of those magical opportunities that a lot of people don't get a chance to be a part of, that it really kind of set my trajectory, you know, in French cuisine. So, you know, you can expect we honor the Italian mindset of the ingredient speaks for itself. You know, if there's a protein or a vegetable as the center of the plate, you're going to taste that. You're going to recognize it. It's present. And the things that we do to it are intended to kind of accentuate the protein, not the focal point, not overpower it or blend it. I don't, you know, there's not a lot of superfluous garnishes of microgreens and things like that. I mean, we really just want to have a very pure and simple concept, but done in a way that is, you know, that honors the tradition of making proper sauces and stocks. And, you know, we butcher all of our fish in house. So, you know, our staff gets a chance to see and experience and learn this, these skills that oftentimes, you don't get a chance to learn because people are always finding ways to be more efficient and effective and cut labor. And, you know, if you can buy a portion of fish versus the whole fish, you know, I think a lot of people opt for that approach as opposed to kind of doing the work, making the bread in house, making the cheeses in house, make, you know, everything that we can possibly make, the pasta is made in house, you know, everything is made in house so that we can kind of continue to train our next generation of chefs and they're able to continue to feed us in a meaningful way that nourishes us and you know, excites future generations of chefs to continue the endeavor.
What are some of your favorite dishes on the menu or dishes that people say, oh my gosh, I go there every time and I get this?
I think pasta in general is universally loved and it doesn't matter what nationality you are, where you come from. You know, almost everybody has pasta in their, you know, in their culture, has some version of it. And pasta is something that we take very seriously here. We make all of our pastas in house. I had the good fortune to work for a chef named Michael White, who, in my opinion, is one of the great pasta masters of our country. You know, he studied in Italy, is married to an Italian woman, and his, you know, well, everything I learned while working for him for 11 years kind of set me on this path of continuing this great tradition and making sure that the pasta that we put forth here is as good, if hopefully better than any pasta really you've ever had. So I think pasta first and foremost, but, you know, our service is also something we really hang our hat on. You know, we really have some great people here at the restaurant that take their career, their profession very seriously. You know, it's not just a job for them; it's a career for them.
Sure.
And they've devoted their lives to it, and they provide that quality of service that you would expect from, you know, a big city market, you know, around us like Chicago or New York or L.A., and they do it right here in Detroit.
You also have a heart for charity. You launched something called the Culinary Collective. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. When we came back, I wanted to be able to do more. You know, I worked for a big restaurant group that made a lot of money, probably lost a lot of money as well. So it always felt like that it was hard to take care of your staff because growth was always such a priority. And when we set about to open this restaurant, we said, hey, we don't want a bunch of restaurants. We want to have one that's really good and can do some good for the people that work with us, that work alongside us. And it can also do some good for the community around us. And so, that combined with the desire to mentor and to bring chefs in from my past or from around the country that, you know, have had different levels of success and traditional successes in Michelin and things like that, or more commercial successes with, you know, the network and other stuff. So kind of combining those two and bringing in, you know, talented people from around the country that want to come to Detroit and celebrate this, you know, this kind of renaissance that we're having. We started this Culinary Collective in which, you know, each year we've kind of selected a participant or a benefactor. Last year we raised about $10,000 for Forgotten Harvest to feed, you know, people food insecure here in Detroit. And this year we've partnered with Downtown Boxing Gym, which is a great kind of community-based yes. organization here in Detroit that does some amazing things for the, you know, that are a part of that program. So, you know, through this, through ticket sales, we're able to donate, you know, we'll hopefully raise about, 10 grand for Downtown Boxing Gym. And it allows our staff to get involved with these chefs. We bring in culinary students to also, you know, experience, the event and gain contact so that maybe someday when they want to do what I did and, you know, go and learn a skill or a trade somewhere in a different market, they'll have contacts that they can, you know, maybe feel comfortable about and to reach out and say, hey, you know, I met you at Oak and Rio back in, you know, 2023. You maybe have a position for me if I move to St. Louis or New York or Chicago. So that was kind of the catalyst for starting this program. And it's just a fun thing where we get to kind of bring people in and show people our great city. And, you know, took the chef from California. You know, we took him to a concert at Masonic Temple and brought him to dinner. So, you know, you could kind of see and experience the city, and we could kind of give back to them to put some money into some of our coworkers and colleagues' pockets in different restaurants and facilities around the city.
It's a great idea. Before I let you go, you have to tell us about the Upright. That is your lower level cocktail lounge that's opened on the weekend, right?
Yeah, we have a beautiful little speakeasy in the lower level of Oak and Reel. And we're open Fridays and Saturdays from 6 until midnight. And we just kind of started a new program in which we're kind of doing almost like a music-centered experience in which, you know, we kind of curate cocktail lists around a certain genre of music and you know, do this for, you know, maybe a quarter, 2 or 3 months. And so we started with disco this month to kind of get the electronic music festival kicked off. And disco kind of has some of its, you know, some of EDM has, you know, roots in disco. And so, you know, the team we have down there, Jamie and Rebecca, did a great job of curating a cocktail list to go with this. And you know, we had some DJ come in and kick the thing off. And we'll continue to bring in live music. And so it's just a fun opportunity to kind of do something different, you know, and have another facility here that we can use for our guests. You know, you can have a lot of different experiences. And we have two great private dining rooms that seat up to 40 people. You know, we have this cocktail lounge that can be rented out. I mean, we really just have a lot of options for whatever your dining needs may be here at Oak and Reel.
Jared Gadbaugh, owner and chef of Oak and Reel, thanks so much for your time today. It sounds like you are doing a great job there on East Grand Boulevard, and we can't wait to come back and check it out again.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Coming up next on Opportunity Detroit, we've got a great story. It's about the Pope Francis Center's work making a difference in the lives of the homeless. We'll be right back after these messages. You are listening to Opportunity Detroit, sponsored by Rocket Mortgage. The Pope Francis Center has opened the doors to its $40 million Bridge Housing Campus. Father Tim McCabe, the president and CEO of the Pope Francis Center, joins us now to talk about this transformational project. Father Tim, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me on, man.
So let's talk about the history of this. You've been working on this project for a very long time, Father.
Yeah, it's been 9 years. I started at the Pope Francis Center. It was the Warming Center at the time. We renamed it. But, you know, I loved what we were doing down at St. Peter and Paul. We have a beautiful program of providing food and showers and laundry and medical and dental. But I realized pretty quickly, even though we're treating people with love and respect and dignity, that we weren't changing the situation. We're simply like kind of, you know, saving lives by our services. But I really wanted to see something transformational. And so we started talking. Actually, it was born out of some real heartache. We've lost a number of our guests. It was the week before Christmas, and a number of people had four young people died of fentanyl overdoses, and a woman that was murdered, and two more died from lack of medical proper medical care. And so we were kind of reeling from that as a team. We said, boy, it doesn't have to be this way. There are places in the world where they don't have homeless. Why can't Detroit be one of those places? And we started asking that question, and what did we need to do? I went around the country, I benchmarked best practices of 27 different programs in 11 different cities, and I came back and continued to work with our team and with our guests to design a program and a building to actually do that, to end homelessness in Detroit.
That's fantastic. Now, where is this campus, and what does it look like, Father Tim?
Well, it's beautiful. It's on just Warren and 996. It's a 60,000 square foot facility, so it's a very large place. One of the things is we kept it low to the ground, so there's only the residential area only has two floors, and everything else is on the main floor. And so we learned that people are fearful of going up in buildings. So, you know, and all the design elements are about being successful, from the width of the hallways to the colors that we use, all, you know, based on best practices and what we know about trauma. So we understand that trauma is the leading cause of homelessness. And so we're going to approach this as a trauma-informed care approach. But the front of the building where the residents live, you'd think it was a beautiful apartment building. And it's a really well done. Each room, everybody will have their own room, their own bathroom, their own shower. You know, there'll be a bed and a dresser and a desk in each room. And it's about learning how to live. You know, it's life skills. You know, how do you take care of a place after you've been on the street for years and don't have those skills anymore? So we also have a gymnasium. We have a complete health clinic that's available to the neighbors as well as our guests. So that will be, it's a federally qualified health clinic. We'll have a doctor on staff 40 hours a week, along with nursing staff. So it'll be run by Chad's clinic. We have a gymnasium for exercise and for, you know, multi-purpose room. We have classrooms. We have a commercial kitchen where we will not only prepare the meals for the people living here, but we can teach them how to work in a restaurant, how to prepare food, how to wash dishes. You know, it's designed to be a training kitchen. We have a family room, a library, and we even have an outdoor shelter area where there's a percentage of people who are homeless that can't come indoors because of their level of the trauma. And so there's an outdoor area that during the winter, they'll be protected from the elements. There's heated sidewalks around the perimeter with radiant heat above them where they can sleep outdoors. Then we can continue to kind of encourage them and help them to imagine something different for themselves as they'll be right here on our campus.
So it's designed to be transitional, correct?
That's right. Mm-hmm. We expect, based on what I saw around the country and what we know about our own guests that we see down at the church, most people will be able to transition between 90 and 120 days. You know, we'll be able to stabilize them. We're addressing mental illness. We're addressing addiction, you know, kind of with a understanding that trauma is underneath all of it. And so we'll have a psychiatrist on our team, like social workers, housing specialists. We'll all be working together with them to move them into what most people will end up in. It was what's called permanent supportive housing. So they'll be in a place that has their own place, like an apartment, but there's support services in those buildings.
And will you have requirements for the residents? So in order for them to live there, they have to do X?
Sure. They'll have to participate in keeping the building nice. You know, they'll have their house jobs. They'll participate in group sessions, group therapy sessions. They'll be expected to participate in a programming of, you know, educational programming, life skills, job readiness. You know, we'll have it. It's all designed. And so there'll be like three courses a day that they'll be expected to participate in. And then, you know, just house jobs like you would if you lived at home, right?
Sure.
You have your kids. Someone has to take out the garbage, someone has to clean the dishes. So that's, you know, and that's part of them taking ownership and belonging here.
Absolutely. Now, are you already full? I can imagine. My gosh, you probably have a waiting list already. This is incredible.
Yeah, we do have a waiting list. We haven't started actually taking people in. We'll do that in a couple of weeks. We did our ribbon cutting Monday, and then we're we'll take 10 people a week for 4 weeks until the facility is full. But there is already a waiting list, and people are coming from other places, other parts of the state and other parts of the country.
Really?
Because our reputation is out there, and they want to, hopefully, and that's what I want. My goal is to change the national conversation about what homelessness is, why people are homeless, and what the solution is, or what the what's effective in treating it.
So other people are already coming here and taking a look at this concept to see if perhaps they could do something like this in other parts of the country, because homelessness is a huge issue, as we both know, throughout the world.
Yeah, it is. And so I've had people from Philadelphia, Idaho. Our largest donor is from California, and they'd like to see it templated out in California. So
yes,
they've been kind of keeping up tabs on us. We've had calls from New York. So I think this is a real solution. I think, you know, it's not rocket science. It's just really about relationships and really understanding homelessness as trauma and giving them the love and compassion and the space to heal from what put them on the streets and help them. You know, and being with them on the journey. Like, once they leave here and they go into permanent housing,
yes,
you know, that's not the end of the story. We walk with them because we know that, you know, mental illness and addiction is not always a straight path. You know, there's relapses, there's setbacks. And so we want to be with them when that happens to continue to kind of encourage them on the path.
Now, I know you put your heart and soul in this. You raised $40 million, most of the funding from private donations. Wow, I bet you are just really touched by what people have done here for this project, Father Tim McCabe.
You know, I really am. You know, at the beginning, we hired experts, and they said, you can't do it. You'll never be able to do it. You don't have an alumni base. You don't have a database. But I knew Detroit is one of the most generous places,
yes,
on earth, and that's what we do. We take care of one another. We come up with solutions, and we step out. You know, we don't see limitations. We see possibilities. And I just knew that if I took this, and right away, you know, Ford Motor Company came in, you know, Lear came in, Magna International came in. They just all said they want to be a part of this, and it just snowballed. And recently at our ribbon cutting, we had the lieutenant governor, the speaker of the house, the mayor, the city council president, you know, the council member for this district, all on the two coaches, all on the stage, you know, all wanting to be a part of this and have been a part of it. So I am awed beyond belief by the generosity and the love and concern that I've seen from all walks of life. And I say this all the time, and that it's, you know, people have picked up on now that when we all work together, miracles happen.
Yes.
And this is it. It's when the city and the state and the business community and the religious community and the nonprofit sector, when we are all working together on a common solution, this is what happens. It's a miracle.
Oh, such a great story. Father Tim McCabe, President and CEO of the Pope Francis Center, thank you so much for your time today, and congratulations on getting this done and on this amazing project.
Thank you so much, Ann. Lovely to talk to you, as always.
And I'm Ann Thomas. Thank you for listening to Opportunity Detroit. I hope you enjoy the rest of your day.